Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. I would now like to welcome writer Bill Dubuis. He has recently been in Washington, D.C., and we're here today to talk about the border between Mexico and the United States. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's great to be here with you, Mary Charlotte.
So the nearly 2,000 miles of border, I think it's 1,951 or 52 miles that separate our two countries, it's a long border. What has been the nature of that border and the implicit barrier between the two countries traditionally?
Well, there's a wonderful book from years past about the regions of the United States. And one of the regions really is the borderlands. And this author put forth the idea that the borderlands are a place of their own. They're not like any other place. It's part Mexico. It's part United States. There's a different culture along the border, a kind of breathing in and breathing out the exchange of culture, the exchange of ideas, the exchange of genes, as you know, families live on both sides of the border. And so it's always been a place of mixture. In a way, one way to think of the border, it's not the edge, it's the juncture.
Right. So it's really not a line. It's a space. And of course, if you think about it, it's kind of an ever-moving space, because where we're sitting right here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, far from the border at El Paso, used to be Mexico.
That's right. That's right. And the borderlands have their own flavor. They have their own culture. They also, to a large degree, have unusual, if not unique, ecologies. It's one of the, from the mountains of California and northern Baja to the mouth of the Rio Grande, the border runs through some of the most ecologically diverse and interesting land in North America.
So, in years past, for example, let's say around the middle of the century, was there a border patrol in the middle of the 20th century? Were there all sorts of barriers keeping people from coming north?
Well, there have always been control points at the urban crossings, but through the rural reaches of the border, people would just walk back and forth or ride. I mean, in the ranches in New Mexico down on the border and in Arizona, cowboys would come up from Sonora or Chihuahua, work on a U.S. ranch, and just ride back and go back. In fact, a lot of people have read Cormac McCarthy's great book, All the Pretty Horses. In that, a couple of three U.S. teenagers, basically, or young men, maybe they're 20 or more, just ride south, of course, across the border. And there was that kind of free-flowing exchange until very recently. And the big change has really occurred in the last 5-6 years. And it's grown out of a great deal of fear in the United States about the impact of northbound immigration on U.S. jobs in particular. But it's not just economics. The fears run deeper. There are cultural fears, there are fears about language, there are fears about crime, all kinds of things that are not necessarily very well rooted in the facts of the matter.
When my Italian grandparents came over from Italy in the second decade of the 20th century, they went through Ellis Island, and it wasn't exactly perhaps the very most pleasant crossing, but it was fine. They were wanted. The United States wanted the labor, so they had a, you know, both generous and self-serving immigration policy to get people from countries like Italy to the United States. Why did that change so much? We still, I mean, just looking around Santa Fe, looking around virtually any restaurant in the United States, we still want the labor.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, during World War II, when most of the workers in the United States were involved in the war effort, And the men in particular were soldiers and airmen and sailors. The United States instituted what was called the Bracero program,
right,
to bring Mexican workers north of the border to pick the crops and do a lot of the work that needed to be done. And so we've had that experience. And we've also had, at various times, efforts at wholesale immigration reform. There was a big solution in Reagan's years.
Now, and speaking of the Bracero program, as soon as it was over, those folks were no longer welcome.
Well, that's right. When it was terminated, then they were told to go home and stay home. And I'm not an expert by any means on the history of immigration, but we've been welcoming when we've needed the labor, and we've been very unwelcoming as a nation when there is a perception that we don't need the labor, and that
which
perception
is different from not needing it.
Which is very different. But the Hispanicization of North America is certainly continuing, and you see it, you know, in meatpacking plants in Iowa, in small towns in North Carolina. It's not just a matter of the borderlands anymore.
Now, you were saying that under Reagan, there was a kind of anti-immigrant movement.
No, there was an effort. There was widespread amnesty granted people who were in the United States, and a path to citizenship was provided for those people.
Yeah, it was actually under Clinton that more of a difficult situation arose.
Well, it's been up and down and back and forth for a long time, and I really don't know the details of that. The thing that's been of greatest concern to me is the approach taken in the last few years to build a barrier all along the border of the United States, and something called the Secure Fence Act passed a few years ago and called for the construction of what the legislation calls a fence, but what is in fact a wall on 700 miles of our 2,000-mile border. And to date, over 600 miles of those barriers have been constructed. And where they've been constructed, they've created many, many more problems than they've solved.
Well, the first problem is these fences cost a lot of money. But getting beyond that, what are some of the other problems?
Well, you know, there's a saying that every complex problem has a simple solution. That is completely wrong. And that's the case with building a wall to control northward migration. The wall's bad. It's a disaster fiscally. It's a disaster environmentally in terms of the environmental impacts it has. It's a disaster legally, because in order to build the fence, basically all federal, state, and local laws were suspended, were waived on almost 500 miles of that 700-mile stretch.
Now, I think that's a very important point to just stop and look at for a moment. The Real ID Act of 2005 basically had language in it that suspended the rule of law, federal, state, and local laws, in the building of the fence. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, in fact, it's kind of interesting that, you know, in making presentations on this, the number of laws suspended in order to build the border fence under this authority that was granted to the Secretary of Homeland Security in the Real ID Act, the number of laws that were suspended when Secretary Chertoff exercised the waiver are too numerous to fit on a PowerPoint slide. You can't get them all on the slide and have it be legible. And it's not just environmental laws. It's the Religious Freedom Act, which applies to Catholics and Protestants as well as practicers of native religions. It includes cultural and grave protection acts. It includes the National Historic Preservation
Act. So in other words, they can build it over cemeteries, they can build it over historical buildings, they can build it over wetlands, they can build it over bird migratory.
And they've done all these things. Right now, a section of wall is being constructed in a federally designated wilderness area, the Otay Wilderness Area, which is just east of San Diego in the mountains of the California Coastal Range. And the kind of clumsiness that comes with this kind of haste and this kind of unplanned activity is illustrated by the fact that a section of the wall constructed right through Nogales didn't take into account drainage in that area, so that when big rains came last summer or the summer before, I can't remember which one, there were 8 feet of water in the Mexican part of Nogales, drowning their downtown and filling shops and houses with water.
Oh my goodness! And of course, they have no recourse.
Yeah, I don't know what settlement has been made for them, if any, but these kinds of problems of drainage and erosion, just elementary, basic things that you want to take into account with any kind of engineering project, have been just brushed aside with the construction of the wall.
Have there been legal challenges to this? It seems like suspending the rule of law might be, unconstitutional?
That's right. Defenders of Wildlife and the Sierra Club and a group of other nonprofits sued under this, and their case was appealed all the way to the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court refused to hear it. It was not granted cert, as they say. Yeah. And so the case was never fully tried. But there's a strong case there that the suspension of such a wide array of law, it's the largest suspension of a law in the U.S. legal history. And that's not me saying that. That's the Congressional Research Service saying that this is the broadest suspension of law in U.S. history. It's really a constitutional issue. And still today, of course, the Secretary of Homeland Security, who is now Janet Napolitano, has this authority. And one of the things that activists on this issue are seeking is a firm assurance from Secretary Napolitano that she will not use this authority.
We're talking to writer Bill Dubuis about the border between the United States and Mexico. Let's go into the environmental issues in the border fence in some more detail. There are issues. Now, birds can migrate over fences, but land animals cannot.
That's right. And so the impacts on wildlife of this fence are enormous and very hurtful. For instance, down in the lower Rio Grande, all the way down close to the Gulf of Mexico, there is a string of wildlife refuges, both federal land and Nature Conservancy and Audubon Preserves and so forth. This kind of necklace or series of beads of protected land. And the presumption in the protection of these lands is that the animals using these areas would be able to go from one to another using the corridor of the river. And this is some of the most ecologically diverse land in North America. This is where you find the jaguarundi. This is where you find the remaining 100 ocelots in the United States. This is where you find all kinds of creatures that are reaching the northern limit of their range. Well, the border wall down in that area is permanently and decisively separating each of these little jewels from the others, so that the animals can't move, and it basically renders all the many millions of dollars that we have taxpayers as well as supporters of nonprofits have spent to protect these lands just going down the toilet. And the ocelots, for instance, are substantially doomed now.
Has it already been built?
Yes, a lot. Most of the border wall in this area has been built, and it's been built on people's private land. One family came home to find that the wall had been built in such a way that they could not get to their house.
Oh my goodness!
The wall is being built along the levees, and the levees of the Rio Grande, and any property between the levee and the river channel, which is to say the international border, is then walled off. And because there wasn't proper planning, because there wasn't consultation, there aren't in place agreements for gates. There, people didn't know what was happening to their land. People who have been on that land for, you know, six and seven generations suddenly find that they can't access their land.
So what, for example, the people who couldn't get to their house, what happened?
Well, they went to the Border Patrol and they said basically, whoops, and excuse us, we didn't know you had a house there. And I'm not sure how that is going to be resolved, but you can imagine there are many, many property-related lawsuits being filed in courts in South Texas now.
But the fact that this completely circumvents the rule of law means what? They don't have a chance?
Well, all they can do is go to the government and sue for compensation for the taking of their property. But so they can't reverse the fact of the wall.
So all of this is happening because of what? I mean, there's a very strange kind of illogical mindset that happened after 9/11, which was an attack by mostly people from Saudi Arabia. We attacked Iraq. That was kind of illogical for WMDs that weren't there. And then we decided that everybody from every other country was a threat because of the World Trade Towers, so we put a border fence along Mexico. I mean, is this part of that whole post 9/11 mentality?
Yes, I think that's fair to say. And it's rooted in fear. I mean, we do need to have a secure border. We need to be able to operate our laws on our side of the border, and we need to be able to control immigration into the country in some fashion. But one of the things that's happening with the construction of this wall is that when in the Clinton administration the first elements of wall were being built in urban San Diego, let's say, or in urban El Paso, the presumption was that the walls would be effective because people wouldn't then try to cross over in the deserts because the deserts were too hostile. And that was a completely wrong presumption. People just, instead of moving through the urban areas, they would go through the rural desert area. And the wall has not had any appreciable impact on crossings or on arrests. In most cases, the Border Patrol, with augmented manpower, was gaining operational control of the border, and arrests and apprehensions were going down before the construction of the wall began. Right now, crossings are down, but not because of the border, because of two things. One is the recession in the United States, so people aren't coming north as much because there aren't the jobs here. And crossings are also down because people who have come north don't go home because they can't get home and come back as
right.
easily, so they're trapped here.
Right.
And so for that reason, traffic across the border has gone down. The wall, what it has done is pushed people out into using more and more difficult and austere portions of the desert. And so now deaths from border crossings in recent years now exceed over 5,000 deaths, known deaths. There are many other deaths out there that haven't
been documented.
Haven't been documented. And just for comparison, I mean, people think of the Berlin Wall as having been a horrible and deadly thing, and it certainly was a horrible thing, and there were many deaths, but there were less than 300 deaths over the whole existence of the Berlin Wall. There have been over 5,000 with this wall just in recent years. So, you know, one of the other areas in which this wall is a disaster, I think, is in what it does to sort of the moral standing and the moral character of the United States. By building a wall, we're putting ourselves in the country of the company of the Ming Dynasty, Emperor Hadrian, modern Israel, and the Soviet Union.
Right.
And I don't think that's the team we want to be playing on.
Right.
We can have operational control of our border, without building a wall that hurts the environment, that hurts people's lives, and that is so corrosive to our national ideals and our national standing.
There are concerns about workers coming in, which are by and large, in my personal view, hypocritical, because as long as there's a job that somebody wants to pay a person from south of the border to do, then they should have some sort of standing in this country. But then there's another issue, which is drug trafficking. Are the people who are trafficking drugs across the border using the same routes as the workers who are crossing the border to work in construction and meatpacking plants and restaurants?
I can't really answer that, but what I've heard is that most of the drugs are coming through established border crossings. They're being smuggled in vehicles and
in
so forth.
In large trucks full of other things.
Yes. But at the same time, there are drugs and other materials being smuggled across the border. And as people are pushed out into more and more areas, more and more remote areas, they find themselves in under the control, increasingly, of the narcotraficantes. Those are the people who have the reach to control the most rural areas. And so by constructing the wall, we're pushing the immigration activity and the drug activity together.
Mm.
And that's to everyone's disadvantage.
Indeed.
And where in the past, many of the coyotes, the people who assisted people in crossing the border, could operate at very small scale and sort of impressionistically on the outskirts of, let's say, Ciudad Juarez or around Columbus or places like that.
There were a lot of people who did that and brought their cousins. And
that's right. Now, increasingly, the coyotes are tied with the narcotraficantes because these are people who are organizing and defending turf. So this is a really worrisome trend that the border wall is forcing.
Now, that means that people who are workers who want to cross to look for work here have to pay more and are more subject to the kind of violence that goes hand in hand with drug trafficking.
Exactly right, yeah. Yeah, it puts those people even more at risk.
So let's talk more about the fears and the mindset that causes Americans to build walls.
Well, you know, there's a long tradition in the United States of what historians called nativism, wanting to, you know, at one time we needed to keep the Catholics out because they would corrupt our Protestant ethic and national culture, and so the Irish Catholics were, you know, sort of barrioed or ghettoized in Hell's Kitchen in New York or in the slums of Boston. We got over that, and then it was the Eastern Europeans, and we got over that, and it was another group, and you know, we wanted the Chinese to come over to work on the railroads, but then we didn't want them to live in our communities. Right here in Santa Fe, the immediate post-war subdivisions deed restrictions, basically, that you couldn't sell houses in a subdivision to someone who was Hispanic or Chinese or of any but a gringo
Hispanic?
Ethnicity. Even Hispanic.
In Santa Fe?
Even in Santa Fe, yeah. In some of the old subdivisions, immediately post-war. And this was common throughout the United States. So we make progress. We look at the election of Barack Obama. We do make progress. And one of the things that, I just came yesterday from Washington, D.C. I was helping out with a group of people lobbying against the border wall. And that multi-day effort sort of reached its crescendo. Yesterday evening, there was a reception at an art showing in the House, in the Rayburn office building on the House side. And these were photographs that document what the wall is doing to the landscape of the borderlands. And they're beautiful photographs and well worth seeing. And people who want to see them, if you call up the League of International Conservation Photographers on the web, you can find a portfolio of the photography. Anyway, at the reception, it was very well attended. I wasn't able to be there. I was already on an airplane coming back here. But I've heard from my friends who were there. Quite a number of members of the house came to the reception. And the last member of the house to show up was the great John Lewis, one of the great living Americans, John Lewis, who, you know, rode the bus to Montgomery, the March on Selma. He was beaten by racists in Alabama and Georgia repeatedly and just kept putting his body at risk, and is now a congressman from Georgia and really one of the most inspiring people, I think, alive in America today. Anyhow, at the end of the reception, John Lewis spoke. And he spoke in a way that brought tears to the eyes of the other people there, and just said, never give up, don't give up, keep fighting. And there really is that element, that sense on this border issue, as on in civil rights, in the days when John Lewis was putting himself at such risk. There's this confluence of human rights concerns, of a struggle for people not to be ignored, and hopefully eventually we will prevail on this. Representative Raul Grijalva of Arizona has introduced legislation to halt construction of the border wall and to require any structures built along the border to be subject to law, to be subject to planning, etc. And this legislation would also make possible and require mitigation funds to cure some of the problems that have been created by sections of the wall already built. And so that bill is now in the hopper in the House, and hopefully we can move that forward and get it through. Its prospects for passage are not terribly good, however.
Where do Democrats fall down on this? Traditionally, immigration reform and immigration issues have been kind of mixed. Maybe liberal Democrats are more in favor of openness in immigration, and Republicans are more closed. But there's a lot of space in the middle where people are going back and forth.
Well, that's exactly right. And some people regard this issue as a word I heard in one senator's office, not a New Mexico senator, but a senator from another state, was that the issue is radioactive. They just don't want to touch it. They're really afraid of it because it is subject to so much fear reaction. People can say, yeah, basically, we're being invaded. We need to defend ourselves and so forth, and go to these quick little sound bites that distort the truth, but that are very persuasive.
Well,
for a lot
sort
of people.
Of disease metaphors.
Yes, they are, and the swine flu doesn't help.
Right.
In the House, I think the Grijalva bill has a chance of making some decent progress. In the Senate, one of the things we learned was that there seems to be some consensus in the Senate that dealing with the border wall can't be done alone, that the only way the border wall will be dealt with is through large-scale comprehensive immigration reform. And that's an enormous subject matter. And goodness only knows where that's going to come out. The Obama administration has said it wants to take that up, but first it wants to deal with global climate change and comprehensive United States health care reform. And so there's immigration reform is down the list of a number of very, very important things, so we don't know when we're going to get to it.
You know, what's an interesting point is that I just learned in the T.R. Reid lecture the other night at the Lenzic that Mexico is instituting universal health care on the 1st of January of the coming year. which means that maybe the border wall is going to keep people from going south to get proper health care. I mean, I'm just kidding in the second part, but it certainly is a reason for people to stay in Mexico.
Yeah. Well, the United States is lagging badly on that subject. No question about that.
We're talking to writer Bill Dubuis about the border between Mexico and the United States. So you went to Washington to talk to, what, our elected representatives about this issue?
Yes, yes.
And how did that go?
Well, I think it went well. I'm very proud of our New Mexico delegation. And I think we found at least sympathy on this issue from all five members of our delegation. And I didn't in every instance meet with the member of Congress, but with staff from all five offices and with three of the principals. And so our people, I think, understand this issue. Our people want to do the right thing. It's just finding the right way to do it, the opportunity, the timing, finding a way to cut through the maze of issues that entangle the border. But one hopeful sign, I think, is that Secretary Napolitano, I think, is going to be wants to handle the border wall issues correctly. Right now, she's one of the most overworked and understaffed members of the cabinet.
Really?
Yeah, she doesn't have any of her assistant secretaries, or as far as I know, even deputy assistant secretaries in place. And so she is, most of the people who work for her are holdovers from the Bush administration, and they're not always very sympathetic to what she wants to do. And in addition to just the regular run of business, she's been made the point person on the administration's response to the swine flu outbreak. So she's just absolutely swamped. Just swamped. But I think she's going to do the right thing, and I think if people communicate with her and encourage her, that will help as well.
We're talking to Bill Dubuis. If you could, looking at the whole thing as you've done, and you know, you are also, and we'll be talking about this in future programs, a person who writes about and looks at issues of nature, the environment, climate change. You travel all over the world. You travel very deeply here into New Mexico. You've seen these things from an environmental point of view on the borderland, from a cultural point of view, from a political point of view. If you, in your view, could do the right thing, what would the right thing be right now?
Well, I think we were on the right track before the Secure Fence Act came along. We had beefed up our border patrols. We were using some high-tech stuff that was working some of the time. We were gaining the ephemeral operational control of the border that people wanted. The main thing we need to do, though, is belly up to the issue of comprehensive immigration reform. We need to have a system of work visas so that people can come over here and be here and work here legally and go home and come back and lead a decent life and be treated as human beings. These are issues that touch on the most basic human rights, and they touch on the character of this country. So we also, when we get spooky about things, as all people do, we need to be able to pause and think things through and do the kind of planning that needs to be done. I mean, right now in New Mexico, people, not many people know it, but one of the five free-roaming herds of bison, of buffalo, in North America, moves between New Mexico and Chihuahua through a section of the boot heel. And just building vehicle barriers through there, if those vehicle barriers are designed in the wrong way, those bison are going to stop migrating back and forth. And that's going to impair their future for continuing to exist down there. They're a wonderful feature of that region, and they embody a kind of hope for restoration of the grasslands there in northern Chihuahua and southern New Mexico. They're the kind of thing we ought to look at as a true treasure, which is what it is. So with just a little bit of proper planning, we can have the vehicle barriers we want and not impair the ability of the bison and the pronghorn antelope and the deer and everything else to move back and forth as they need to do.
We get then into questions of human rights and the rights of non-human life and the connection between those two, which Terry Tempest Williams has written very eloquently about, and many other people as well.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, the question of rights for rocks has been out there for a long time. What do we owe the land, you know, which supports us, which allows us to be here? And particularly, what do we owe, this is my particular spin on it, what do we owe the wet places in the Southwest, the rivers like the Rio Grande? You know, we are in the West an oasis civilization. Our towns are where they are because, in large measure, because of the water sources that make them possible. Is it right for us to just deplete those water sources entirely, using them for human purposes, or do we owe something to the Rio Grande, to the Colorado River, to keep those ribbons of green alive, those ribbons of green that also support so much other life, non-human life?
Which in turn ultimately supports us.
Exactly, exactly.
Bill Dubuis, tell us about Friendship Park in San Diego.
Well, Friendship Park was established back in the 70s by Pat Nixon, the First Lady, Richard Nixon's wife. And it was one of the things that she was proudest of in that whole period of U.S. history, one of the things she was proudest of that she did as First Lady. She went down to the border at San Diego, where San Diego and Tijuana touch, and Friendship Park was established. She had her security people go forward and actually cut the three strands of barbed wire there, and a monument was erected. And this is a place where families would come together, they would picnic, communion was served across the border. It was a place where people from Mexico and people from the United States would gather and were allowed to gather. Friendship Park today is divided by the border wall.
Oh, heavens.
You cannot get to the monument at the heart of Friendship Park. It is now perhaps the most ironical park in the world. And the symbolism has not been lost on the people there. One of the people I was lobbying with, John Finessel, goes down and serves communion. He's a minister, and he serves communion through the gaps in the wall, and was arrested for doing this not long ago, or pushed out by the guards there. So think about that image as describing now the United States' approach to friendship across the border.
Let's talk for a moment about the fence itself. What's it made of? Why is it so hard to get across? Does it have vulnerabilities? Have people cut holes in it?
All of those things. The fence is made of different things in different reaches and different designs. It's mostly steel and wire mesh. And in most areas, it's 18 feet tall. And Janet Napolitano, when she was governor of Arizona, was famously recorded to have said, "Show me a 50-foot fence, and I'll show you a 51-foot ladder." The fences really don't work. They do slow people down, and that's about all. And one thing from a fiscal point of view is that the fences are extremely expensive to build. They cost anywhere from $1 million to $12 million per mile. And we're talking about 700 miles of this stuff in the secure fence.
Yeah, we've already spent well over $1 billion on this.
That's right. And the maintenance for the fence runs to about 15% of construction cost per year, which is to say that inside of 7 years, we will have spent more on maintenance than we did on original construction. So we're buying ourselves a very, very expensive thing to keep around.
Is there any movement to have it taken down in certain places?
You know, I think a lot of people would love to see it taken down. Right now, what we're focusing on is stopping the continued construction of it.
I want to end with just a discussion of what is, and we've started to talk about it, but what is the nature of this fear that allows Americans to distort the facts and to get into a place of demonizing a whole people or demonizing a whole group, which is just simply not, quote-unquote, not us. We're demonizing a language. People, I mean, I've heard on the news, I think actually on the BBC, somebody in a town in Iowa where there were a lot of Latino immigrants saying, I can't even go into this certain restaurant on my own street and hear English, damn it. So, I mean, that happens on Cerrillos Road. There are certain places you go to. It's pretty hard to get a sandwich unless you speak Spanish. But that fear has rage and righteousness and all sorts of things with it. And I'm having trouble really understanding the psychology of it.
Well, you know, along the border, people have lived biculturally for a long, long time. You know, here in Santa Fe, we're not on the border, but we're close.
Right.
And Spanish is all around us, and we have a great Hispanic heritage here. You know, Hispanos were here centuries before Anglo-Americans showed up. So we have at least some sense of a bicultural environment here. The greatest resistance to immigration, the greatest fear relating to the border, I think lies in areas that are some distance from the border, among people who don't have that experience of biculturalism. And an interesting thing that's happening is that not only are people from the south moving north across the border, but people from the north are moving south to the edges of the border. Phoenix, Southern California are filled with many Anglo-Americans who come from more distant areas, and I think the fears about the border are reached their apogee with these people. They want to go right to the edge of the United States and feel as though it's just as white bread as Chicago was, or Peoria was, or wherever they came from.
Chicago being so very black, anyway.
Right. But so people are looking for... They want to be able to sit there behind the gate of their gated community and eat nachos and sip margaritas and not have to be in a bicultural environment, notwithstanding what they're eating and drinking.
Well, they're happy to have Mexican or Latin people serving them.
That's right, as long as they behave themselves, yes.
So,
there's a fear of losing control, of losing what some people think America is about, which is a kind of Protestant Anglo-American culture. And folks feel that eroding, notwithstanding that it's always been changing. And America has always been invigorated by immigration at every stage in its history. And it's receiving that invigoration today.
What do people who think in this way think is going to be lost? Their own jobs? Their own... I mean, what?
Some of the fear is economic about jobs. I think a lot of the fear is control.
And what are they controlling?
Well, they're controlling the political system. They're controlling the cultural norms through their majority. Some of the fiercest tension between Anglo and Hispano is in the fields of the Imperial Valley in California, where most of the land is owned by Anglos, and most of the workers are Mexicano. And it's out of that environment that the most aggressive advocates for the border wall have come politically. And I think there's an undercurrent of fear of losing control of the politics of Imperial County and of Riverside County.
It's funny that it's called Imperial County.
Yes.
We're talking to Bill DeBuys. So what's next for you in your observation of this issue? Are you writing about it? Are you going to go back to D.C.?
I'm going to try to write about it, and I don't know if I'll go back to D.C., but I'll certainly watch very closely to see what happens to Representative Grijalva's bill on this issue. And I'll just try to, you know, put my oar in the water when I can, when it is useful, to try to bring some sanity to the politics of the border wall.
And what can ordinary citizens do?
Well, I think people can make their views known to their representative officials. They can write to members of Congress. And they can talk it up. You know, just organize and educate. Organize and educate. That's what we need to do on all things.
Bill DeBuys is a writer, longtime New Mexico resident. We've been talking about the border between Mexico and the United States. Thanks so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It's my pleasure. Thanks.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Brian Highhill for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Hasta la vista. Ciao.